This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Wallace in Love, The Untold Life of the Duchess of Windsor, The Woman Who Changed the Monarchy. Written by Andrew Morton. Read by Molly Parker Myers. This program includes a Mac and PC compatible PDF of photographs. To my mother, Kathleen. Introduction. The Grand Jas Cemetery lies to the north of the Riviera Resort of Cannes, the 9-hectare site bounded by the road to the perfume-making town of Grasse. A brief but stiffish uphill climb brings the curious and the grieving to the entrance of the Protestant portion of the 150-year-old cemetery. The stone pillars supporting the stern iron gates bear the legend, "I believe in the resurrection of the dead," in both French and English. Inside is a roll call of the famous, the well-known, and the simply anonymous, who were drawn from around the world to make Cannes their home and their final resting place. The English Square, known also as the Cimetière Anglais, is dominated by a statue of Henry Brougham, who turned Cannes from a sleepy fishing village into the resort town it is today. Laid to rest among the quiet rows are sculptors, singers, pioneer pilots, dukes, soldiers, including two holders of the Victoria Cross, the United Kingdom's highest military honor, and Peter Carl Fabergé of the Russian jewelry family, whose eggs crusted with diamonds, rubies, sapphires, and other gems were gobbled up by the last Russian Tsar. There is a Nobel Prize winner, French biochemist Jacques Monod, a rhyme of poets, including the Irish bard William Bonaparte Wise and writer Klaus Mann, son of Death in Venice author Thomas, as well as the ballerina Olga Koklova, Pablo Picasso's first wife. There are lesser lights, too. Those originally from Camden Town in North London, for example, or Victoria in Australia, and beneath a stand of cypress trees, ones from Hyde Park in Upper New York State. While the Americans are well outnumbered by the British, this grave, with its badly discolored headstone, intrigues. What an extraordinary story the marble slab covers over of the three silent inhabitants who lie beneath. It is the grave of Herman Livingston Rogers, his first wife, Catherine Moore, and his second wife, Lucy, or Marie Lucie Catherine, as she styled herself in later life. The inscriptions on the gravestone state that the first wife was beloved, the second devoted. But what of the third woman who also loved the wealthy Renaissance man who counted princes and presidents in his circle? She was born in a wooden shack in a mountain holiday resort and named Bessie Wallace Warfield. She married a Navy pilot, a shipping broker, and a king. She deeply touched the lives of all three occupants of this particular plot in Grand Jas, and many more beyond. Though a king gave up his throne for her, it was Herman Livingston Rogers whom she called the love of my life. He was her best friend, companion, advisor, and surrogate husband, just days before she married her royal suitor, a man who had prostrated himself and his kingdom in order to win her hand. She seemingly offered to have Herman's child. She was an unlikely seductress, more interested in cooking than coitus, her heart under careful control. Nor was this woman who caused so much chaos and commotion in the British Constitution and in the hearts of men much to look at. Raw-boned, square-jawed, outsize hands, and a rasping voice that some found irritating. Yet she enticed men into her orbit, be they single, married, gay, or straight. Women, too, were fascinated by her style and her chutzpah. Wallace was capable of love, passion, and desire, but not always with the men she married. She liked to say that hers was a simple story. It was nothing of the kind. Wallace was an endlessly complex and intriguing woman, beguiling, infuriating. There is no plaque outside her Baltimore home at 212 East Biddle Street in once fashionable Mount Vernon, but there are those who believe she should be remembered with a statue on the famously unoccupied fourth plinth in Trafalgar Square in central London for saving the British from her pro-Nazi royal husband at a critical moment in their island saga as they faced Hitler's eager battalions, war-weary and alone. This is the story of a most extraordinary American who, single-handedly, changed the history of the British royal family and arguably the destiny of the British people. Chapter 1. All is Love. Unkempt, unruly, and untidy, Miss Minerva Buckner was hardly a model teacher. She ignored school bells, bath schedules, and timetables. While she had a brilliant mind and had traveled extensively around Europe, she was feared for her violent temper and mordant wit. The lazy, the slow, and the stupid dreaded her classes, where she taught French and German. Miss Buckner went on like a crazy person. "I want to come home," one of her pupils wrote plaintively to her mother. There was one exception. Bessie Wallace Warfield loved Miss Buckner's classes and adored the somewhat doughy and gangling teacher with a haphazard appreciation of personal hygiene. Miss Buckner was her first love, the besotted teenage schoolgirl sitting at her feet in the wooded grounds of Oldfields Girls' Boarding School as she read the love poetry of Arthur Rimbaud and German poet Rainer Maria Rilke. "You who never arrived in my arms, beloved, who were lost from the start." Indeed, the line from Rilke's "You who never arrived" could have been the theme for Wallace's hopeless juvenile enchantment. Wallace saved her pocket money to buy Miss Buckner presents, on one occasion giving her an enormous fern from a florist in Baltimore, an hour's steam train journey away through the heavily wooded Maryland countryside. Wallace later recalled, "She was very appreciative. She was a very ugly woman, but a very nice one. I took a great fancy to her. I had a huge crush." Wallace was not the only one vying for the attentions of the firmly unmarried Miss Buckner, an outsized personality with the reputation for telling mildly improper anecdotes. In the polite language of the day, her boon companion was fellow teacher Miss Allie McMurrin, the two ladies feeding birds in the woods around Glencoe and going for gentle nature rambles together where they looked for the earliest spring flowers. Wallace was fickle with her heart. She also fell madly in love with the ravishing, if firm, Charlotte Noland, who ran a summer camp for young girls called Burland. Wallace spent long, dreamy days and hot Virginia nights mooning over the svelte, athletic horsewoman and basketball player. In a phrase that could be culled from a modern erotic novel, she described the rangy Miss Noland as a woman with a mixture of gay, deft teasing and a drill sergeant's sternness. She recalled, "I had a terrible crush on Miss Charlotte. Of course, I don't know any girl who hasn't, who ever came in contact with her." She was speaking no less than the truth. When the divine Miss Noland, who later founded Foxcroft Girls' School in Virginia, paid a brief visit to see her sister at Oldfield's all-girls school, half the pupils swooned away. As Wallace's great friend Mary Kirk, who was more than half in love with Wallace herself, wrote to her mother, "By the time she, Miss Noland, is ready to go back, a dozen girls will have developed a crush. Wallace is already that way and terrifically wild with excitement." All the more so when Miss Noland, who later became co-master of the Middleburg Hunt, invited Wallace and Mary for a ride in her new car, stopping at a country store for refreshments. On another occasion in the summer of 1913, she and Wallace, now 17, went together for a tiny little ride together. Such was their intimacy that the boyish Wallace was permitted to call Miss Noland Lottie. The teasing sexual ambiguity of their relationship never fully expressed, nor presumably resolved. This friendship may have made Mary just a little jealous. As she innocently confessed to her mother, "I cannot help thinking about Wallace all the time." That said, Wallace was an equal opportunity admirer. Her passion for Lottie balanced by a crush on her brother Philip, who was more than 20 years Wallace's senior. Much to the irritation of her mother, Alice Warfield, she spent days wailing and sobbing because he left her love unrequited, never responding to her ardent missives. Her school days were a little different from those of many pubescent young girls cloistered in the febrile hothouse atmosphere of a remote all-girls school, where sexual passions were heightened, emotions intense, and every tiny event treated as high drama. When Wallace sang, "Dear delightful women, how I simply love them all," at a concert, she was crooning from her heart. Older pupils treated the mooning behavior of juniors ruthlessly. For example, when Wallace, a school newbie, and another girl were vying for the affection of a senior girl, Wallace was told that she would be chosen only if she bought her gifts or gave her money. In the top-floor dormitory that she shared with Mary Kirk, whom Wallace described as a beautiful little partridge, the two whispered confidences late into the night. However, the chatter between Wallace and the red-haired daughter of America's oldest silversmith was often interrupted by an irate teacher. Their giggly gossip centered around other girls, their teachers, and people they knew. It was not long, though, before their conversational agenda was dominated by one item, boys. Boys were the great unknown, their ways, their looks, and their activities an intriguing, endless mystery. A mystery that Wallace was determined to solve as soon as possible. She was at a distinct disadvantage. The woman who one day would be a byword for grand passion and a barely believable love affair between an English king and an American commoner had known very few males, role models or not, in her young life. For the most part, they were dead, diseased, or distant figures. Her young father, Tekel Wallace Warfield, died of tuberculosis on November 15, 1896, just 5 months after her birth on June 19th. The marriage of her father and mother, Alice Montague, was strongly opposed by both families for obvious reasons. Tekel was in the final stages of a disease that was, at that time, highly contagious and incurable, given the fact that certain strains of tuberculosis cause sterility. It was a miracle that he was even able to father a child. It seems, though, that social proprieties trumped social disease, the couple marrying on November 19, 1895, when Alice was 2 months pregnant with her first baby. This sense of social disgrace perhaps explains why there was no fanfare or newspaper report, just a quiet ceremony in a side chamber of the Church of St. Michael and All Angels in Baltimore. Again, when Wallace was born in a roughly built wooden cottage at the Monterey Inn in the resort of Blue Ridge Summit in the state of Pennsylvania, there was no announcement in the Baltimore newspapers, merely an update on Tekel's declining condition. He breathed his last at the Baltimore home of his elder brother, Solomon Davies Warfield, known as Uncle Sol, just a few weeks after his daughter's christening, which was held at Emmanuel Episcopal Church in Mount Vernon on October 19, 1896. Such was the fear surrounding tuberculosis that her sick father was not allowed to hold or touch her in case he infected his daughter. The poor man was permitted only to look at a photograph of his baby daughter 3 days before he died. the TB epidemic was so severe that trainee doctors at local Johns Hopkins Medical School were instructed to sleep outside during the summer months where the air was fresher. Even a romantic kiss could spell certain death. When Tekle Warfield was buried at Green Mount Cemetery, the family struggled to find pallbearers willing to carry his coffin. After Tekle was laid to rest, his destitute widow found little comfort from her own family. Her father, William Laton Montague, a one-time stockbroker in New York, remained 150 miles south in Richmond, Virginia, with his second wife, Mary E. Hazlitt. There were no offers of accommodation from that quarter. In the narrative of Wallace's life, her maternal grandfather plays no part, even though he stayed with her mother in her terraced house at 212 East Biddle Street during his final illness, dying in April 1909 when Wallace was 12. The one man who did influence her life was her Uncle Saul. In her eyes, he was a grumpy curmudgeon whose grudging charity barely kept her and her mother afloat. However, he was the only family member who invited mother and baby to stay with him and his mother Anna in a three-story townhouse on Preston Street in the Mount Vernon district of Baltimore. From the beginning, it was a socially and physically awkward arrangement. After all, it was Uncle Saul who had led the solemn Warfield family delegation to plead with Alice and Tekle against marriage because of his brother's terminal condition. They ignored him and other family members. With her own family seemingly reluctant to help, Alice threw herself at his mercy. He provided shelter, food, and, in time, paid for Wallace's formal education. Wallace was raised in the bosom of the Warfield family. Just as the infant baby's first names, Bessie Wallace, represented the two sides of the family, being the names of her father and her mother's older sister, Bessie Buchanan Merriman, so she often ascribed the contradictory qualities of her character to the contrasts between the two families, the Warfields and the Montagues. The Warfields were a reputable, somewhat stolid Baltimore family with deep-rooted business and political traditions, prosperous and distinguished. Like many of the Warfield men, Saul was a successful businessman in his own right, a friend to three American presidents, and his financial acumen saw him appointed the youngest postmaster in the city's history. Described by the Baltimore Sun as a remarkable man, sometimes approaching ruthless in his methods. He listed big game hunting, fishing, and golf as his leisure pursuits. Ruthless, though, was not a word that found favor in the Warfield clan. It touched a raw nerve, for they had built their various fortunes on the back of slave labor. Until slavery was abolished in 1865, the family had been slave owners and occasional slave traders, keeping their unwilling flock in order by threatening to sell them south, where conditions were more brutal and inhumane than in Maryland. While there is an 1837 agreement with regard to selling a Negro slave girl named Sally in the Warfield family papers, they considered themselves benign and enlightened masters. Not that many families keep albums of pictures showing a lynching, as the Warfields did. Wallace's third cousin, Edwin Warfield, who was elected 45th governor of Maryland in 1903, gave several speeches on slavery as I knew it. Edwin himself was raised on the Oakdale Plantation in Howard County, where the family's slaves were housed in a long oak cabin. His tolerance went only so far. When he stood for governor, Edwin, a Democrat, did so on a platform of white supremacy, believing that poorly educated blacks should be denied the franchise. As governor, he was involved in an attempted lynching that was as farcical as it was grotesque. In July 1906, shortly after Wallace's 10th birthday, a Negro named William Lee was due to be hanged after being found guilty of assaulting two white women. Such was the outcry that Governor Warfield had the culprit kept in Baltimore jail so as to escape a lynch mob intent on burning him alive. The condemned man was spirited away by steamboat to nearby Somerset County, followed by an angry armada of boats filled with outraged local men. The law narrowly won, and Lee was hanged on a gallows hastily erected on an island in Chesapeake Bay before the mob were able to land. As the whole city of Baltimore was in excited tumult, Wallace would have been aware of the episode, especially as it involved Cousin Edwin. By contrast, the dramas on the maternal side of Wallace's family were entirely domestic. The Montagues were devil-may-care in this life and rarely worried about the devil in the next. The men exuded typical Southern charm, which did not, as Wallace tartly observed, put money in the bank. As she would later describe, they lived a more hazardous, more adventurous life, which was a polite way of saying that they were feckless. As for the women, they were noted beauties, particularly her mother, her Aunt Bessie, and Cousin Corrine, who didn't take life or themselves too seriously. As Wallace's uncle, Major General George Barnett, observed of the Montague clan, "They are wonderful, witty, intelligent people, and they will tell you so themselves." While the contrasting fortunes and characters of the Montagues and Warfields explain Wallace's background, the real emotional dynamic of her life was between Alice, her mother, Anna, her paternal grandmother, and, in later life, her mother's older sister, Aunt Bessie. It is noticeable that in her Baudelaireized memoir, The Heart Has Its Reasons, her grandmother takes early center stage. Prim, proper, upright, she trained Wallace to sit with a ramrod straight back. She always had the well-thumbed Warfield family Bible on a table next to her rosewood rocking chair. In her early 60s and still in her widow's weeds after the death of her husband 20 or so years before, she cut a striking and self-possessed figure sitting alone in the shadows, rocking back and forth, watching and wary, her tongue as sharp as her eyes. Though her grandmother seemed to have stepped out of one of Charles Dickens' brooding Gothic novels, Wallace had, for the most part, fond memories of her, feeling an emotional kinship with a woman of unbending principle and chilly control, aristocratic both in her demeanor and her bearing. She even named her life-size doll, Anna, after this indomitable lady. Kind, peaceful, and full of common sense was Wallace's assessment of her grandmother. Her advice, though, was straight out of a censorious never-never land. Never let a man kiss your hand. If you do, he'll never ask you to marry him. Never marry a Yankee. Never drink coffee. It will turn your skin yellow. Her continuous stream of warnings and counsel bred in Wallace a timidity and caution about the world that lay beyond the thick oak door of 34 East Preston Street. For all these constraints, Wallace felt that she belonged within this conservative, comfortable, and socially significant milieu. The Warfield stood for stability, safety, and most important, status. In Baltimore, a Warfield was somebody. Wallace, prudish and particular, is much more critical of her mother. Even though she acknowledges Alice's endless sacrifices on her behalf, she disapproved of her haphazard values and rackety lifestyle. The sense of disappointment with her mother, who danced and skipped her way through life, is palpable. Small, blonde, with striking blue eyes which Wallace inherited, Alice had a sharp tongue and a quick wit. She had a way of saying something amusing and then looking amazed that her comment made others laugh. Such was the endless flow of bon mots that her friends encouraged her to have her witticisms published. She followed their advice, sending her efforts to the weekly magazine Town Talk. Sample. Why do leaves turn red in the fall? Because there are so many bare limbs around. The editor chuckled, sent her $5, and asked for more. It helped pay the bills. Wallace, though, was not amused, believing that her mother's wit was so pungent and caustic that she lost friends and soured relationships, leaving those at the receiving end of her sarcasm feeling inferior and belittled. As her sister Bessie acknowledged, she had a vindictive tongue, a quality her daughter inherited. Wallace had cause to feel the sting of her mother's waspish barbs. "Nobody is as ugly as Wallace when she is bored," her mother would comment, a phrase calibrated to hurt her daughter. As lighthearted and gay as she seemed, Alice clashed frequently with her daughter, the two women fundamentally differing in desire and ambition. Alice was content with her poor southern background, her daughter never satisfied with her lot, always seeking the next rung up the social ladder. Her first words, recalled members of her family, were not "ma, ma," but "me, me." As a little girl, she named dolls after two of the wealthiest and most glamorous women in America, Mrs. Astor of Virginia and Mrs. Vanderbilt of New York. She would leaf through her mother's magazines, looking at pictures of beautiful women dressed in jewels and furs, and point to them with a long hatpin. Then she would make up stories of balls, banquets, and billets doux, populating this glamorous make-believe world with princes, princesses, kings, and queens. Wallace had two other paper dolls, whom she named ABC and Gubby, two men about town. They were members of the exclusive Men Only Maryland Club, where only the most prestigious and prosperous could enter. She would sit in a corner quietly having imaginary conversations and then fly into a rage if anyone interrupted her, recalled Aunt Bessie. She had the greatest imagination of any child I ever saw. By a strange twist of fate, Wallace's neighbor, who literally lived across the street in Baltimore, was another future luminary, Gertrude Stein, an expressive dreamer who captured the zeitgeist of the jazz era. Stein, who would become the muse to what she called the lost generation of American writers and artists, including Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and Ezra Pound, as well as Pablo Picasso, Henri Matisse, and others, would one day imagine seeing the young Wallace at play across Biddle Street, Baltimore, the street of terraced houses where they both lived. During her days in Baltimore, Stein, who later lived in Paris with her lover Alice B. Toklas, was a student at Johns Hopkins Medical College. Even then, she was a controversial character who challenged the male-dominated faculty while learning to smoke Havana cigars and how to box. In 1903, she wrote QED, one of the earliest lesbian coming-out stories, based on a triangular female relationship and set at Johns Hopkins. Once Wallace became famous, Stein was reminded of those days in Mount Vernon, the novelist penning a story called Ida, in which Wallace was sketched as an example of modern celebrity, of being famous for being famous. The ultimate irony of this relationship by literary association is that, while there is an official city plaque recognizing Gertrude Stein's stay in Baltimore, there is nothing to commemorate the presence of the woman who upturned a royal dynasty. While this imaginative young girl dreamed of being a little princess and was treated as one by the whole family, Wallace's mother was the Cinderella, cleaning, cooking, and sewing, wearing her fingers to the bone to make clothes for her daughter and to sell to neighbors and friends. Wallace later admitted that she happily allowed her mother to sacrifice her health and her energy in order to give her the best. "I had great control over her because she adored me so much. Anything I did was right. I was a poor child and a spoiled child, terribly spoiled." Theirs was an odd kind of penury. They lived rent-free, courtesy of Uncle Saul. They never went hungry. Sunday lunch was invariably roast beef and Yorkshire puddings followed by meringue and ice cream, and had a small army of servants to care for them. In the hot summer months, when Baltimore was unbearable, Wallace had the pick of handsome working farms or country estates owned by her wealthy relatives, Places where donkey rides or visits to the ice house to pick out chilled watermelons were always on the menu. Though Wallace and her mother never lived in poverty, their burden was living as the patronized poor relations. For longer than they cared to recall, they depended on the sporadic and casual charity of Uncle Saul and Alice's sewing ability to pay for the little extras in life. Wallace came to hate springtime, that period of bursting buds and hedgerow bustle, as it was a chirpy reminder that while her school friends went on family excursions, Wallace was left hoping that she would be invited, knowing full well that she could never reciprocate. She remembered spring as a hideous time of year. For a girl who was all about control, her dependence on her uncle stained deep into her psyche. Half a century later, when she was reviewing this time in her life, she remembered how difficult it was for her proud mother to ask for charity, and what she described as her granite-faced uncle's peculiarly sadistic behavior when he handed out his largesse. During this ritual, he would pass Wallace what she called a tip, crunching up his money into a little ball before sliding it into her hand. "You didn't know if you had $5 or 5,000," she recalled. "You could hardly wait to get out of the room. You almost ran to open your hand to see what he had tipped you." She insinuates that her ice-cold uncle had thawed toward her mother to the point where he had declared his love. Beneath the stony visage was a man with a secret appreciation for female opera singers, ballet dancers, and chorus girls, whose signed portraits decorated his bachelor apartment in New York. Understandably, Alice could not tolerate living in such a sexually charged atmosphere with a man she disdained. A subtly disturbing situation seems to have helped precipitate the separation, recalled Wallace. She was young and attractive, living under the same roof, and she and Uncle Saul were inevitably thrown much together. Wallace was all for this possible marriage, feeling that her mother should have sacrificed herself so that Wallace could enjoy the lifestyle of the rich and locally famous. That she spurned his advances perhaps explains why Uncle Saul supplied only the bare financial necessities for Wallace and her mother. "He hated to do anything for me. He did the minimum," she complained. It is an unjust charge, Uncle Saul funding Wallace's education and social life until she married. Certainly he did more, much more, than her mother's family. At the same time, the vivacious widow was increasingly at odds with her disapproving mother-in-law. Both were strong women who did not hesitate to speak their minds. Alice would have found living under another woman's roof and rule frustrating and irritating. That she wanted to make a new life for herself and began seeing suitors merely complicated matters. Eventually, Alice packed their bags and took rooms, first in the Brexton Residential Hotel just a few hundred yards away, and then at the nearby Preston apartment house. Alice, impetuous and careless of the consequences, swapped the relative security, comfort, and compromises of the Warfield home on Preston Street for a much more precarious living, launching a paying dining club for friends and fellow lodgers. As much as Wallace subsequently opined that life was harsh and threadbare, at times her mother was able to hire two African-American maids, a cook and a butler. One butler was a master of the malapropism. When he solemnly told the assembled company, "Dinner is pronounced," Alice burst into gales of laughter, much to the poor man's embarrassment. The specialty of Alice's dining club was Maryland terrapin. Most days a man would come along with a burlap bag filled with terrapin, a delicacy made popular by schooner captain Albert Lavalette Jr., who started an industry selling terrapins for $1 an inch. They were then turned into a delicate soup that cost around $5 a bowl. The degree of difficulty of preparing this dish added an air of luxury to the table. It required not only money, but also the skill and time to prepare it. Only the well-to-do could afford the cost of mastering the recipe. During these dinner parties, it was Alice, not her cook, who took command of the kitchen. She was the one who selected the diamondbacks and put them in the basement to fatten up on cornmeal. After tucking into her carefully prepared feast, washed down with expensive red burgundy, her paying guests played poker late into the night, watched, if she was not spotted, from the top of the stairs by a wide-eyed Wallace. Those were great days, she recalled, certainly more fun than listening to the ticking of the clocks and the creak of Anna's rocking chair in the still shadows of the Warfield residence. However, in her memoir, she painted this time with her mother in darker hues, as a period of privation and poverty. Life was such a struggle always, you didn't have time to sit around and discuss family history. One was wondering where the next meal or dress was coming from, she recalled. She continually complained that her Warfield cousins enjoyed greater ease and certainty than she ever did. This is the heart of the matter. Wallace was brought up in a world where she wanted for nothing except stability, status, and social acceptance. She felt the stigma of being an outsider, a complaint she laid at her mother's door. In the small-minded world of Baltimore's society, gossip inevitably swirled around the pretty, merry widow who had abruptly walked out on the city's postmaster, a pillar of the community, and was now hosting what appeared to be nothing short of a gambling and drinking den. To those of the temperance persuasion, this was only one step up from running a brothel. Even though Uncle Saul paid for her rooms, Alice's dining club was a financial disaster. She cut her losses and lived with her sister Bessie for a time, before moving into her own home, a three-story terraced house at 212 East Biddle Street. Once again, Uncle Saul may have underwritten the enterprise, allowing Alice to graduate from charging for meals to renting rooms. As her sister Bessie commented wryly, Alice didn't live so much hand to mouth as room to room. One paying guest was Johns Hopkins graduate, Dr. Charles F. Bove, who later recalled an exuberant 12-year-old girl with glossy black hair parted in braids like an Indian squaw, who helped her mother serve evening meals. He called her Minnie Haha. She responded with a wide grin. A few years later, she was not smiling at headlines that screamed, "From boarding house to Balmoral," insinuating that Wallace enjoyed a hardscrabble upbringing. As Aunt Bessie indignantly observed, "Did they think we were from Tobacco Road?" At the time, though, the decision by Wallace's mother to run a boarding house was perhaps even more calamitous. The gossips had a field day, hearsay built on rumor to the point where it was whispered that Alice was living with another man. The sins of the mother also condemned the daughter. As a young woman, Wallace was always looked on with suspicion by the matrons of Maryland. Society interior designer Billy Baldwin remembered the local notoriety surrounding Alice and Wallace Warfield. Wallace's mother, a very striking woman, had a lover, and he slept openly in her house, which was impossible for Baltimore ladies to accept. Because of that, when Wallace came out, she was almost déclassé and had a very hard time making the grade. Legend has it that Uncle Saul offered to make Wallace heir to his fortune if she returned to Preston Street and vowed not to see her corrupt mother anymore. Her refusal merely stoked the theory that Wallace was no better than her allegedly dissolute mother. Actually, on June 30, 1908, after more than a decade as a respectable if down-at-heel widow, Alice remarried, this time to John Freeman Rassen, the son of the leader of the local Democratic Party who, it seemed, had lodged in Biddle Street. Once again, she fell for a man who was incapacitated, Rassen suffering from heart disease as well as a chronic and painful kidney complaint, Bright's disease. While Rassen, known as Young Free, was remembered as an indolent fellow, his days spent sitting in his favorite chair, smoking cigarettes and reading the newspaper, it was his ill health that limited his activity. For all his failings, he did have a trust fund which, for the first time, gave mother and daughter a degree of independence from Uncle Saul. Used to being the center of attention, or center of attraction, as she put it, and doted on not just by her mother but her relatives, who considered her an orphan, Wallace was devastated by this turn of events. She steadfastly refused to attend the wedding, which was scheduled to take place in the drawing room at Biddle Street just a few days after her 12th birthday. It took all of Aunt Bessie's soothing powers of persuasion, together with the promise that she could look for a silver thimble, a dime, and a ring hidden in the wedding cake, to convince the sobbing, foot-stomping girl to attend her mother's wedding. The cake paid the price. While the Reverend Francis X. Brady, president of Loyola College, performed the ceremony in front of a small group of family and guests, Wallace was in the dining room turning the cake into Chinese chow in her hunt for silverware. Her behavior provoked indulgent mirth, and from her stepfather, the placatory gifts of a fully stocked aquarium and a French bulldog she called Bully. This episode fostered several life lessons for the young Wallace. Spoiled and self-willed, Wallace thought her mother's second marriage confirmed her belief that if she was betrayed by the woman who loved her unconditionally, then the only person she could truly trust was herself. As she matured, she became her own best advisor, counselor, and friend, rarely showing the outside world any glimpse of what she was thinking and feeling. There was a core of steel to her, a toughness that even her mother could not reach. As Wallace recalled, "I kept greatly within myself, very self-contained, always filled with my own ideas and plans, looking forward, never backward. Right or wrong, I made the big decisions in my life." She always knew her own mind, whether it was choosing the fabric and style of a dress for a social event, or deciding whether or not to call the doctor when she was ill. "Don't call him. All he'll say is spinach and fresh air." There is no denying that little Bessie Wallace Warfield stood out from the herd, a quality greatly admired by her Aunt Bessie. She was always an individual, always something different about her. She was the leader and knew what she wanted. Her self-reliance, though, was a source of frustration for her mother, Alice resenting that she was losing authority over her growing child. On one occasion, Aunt Bessie was giving Wallace some advice when Alice burst out sarcastically, "Why do you bother? Don't you know that Wallace knows everything?" It was a remark that cut deep, feeding a resentment she harbored forever. "That, of course, would humiliate me more than anything in the world," she recalled. Somewhat improbably, she added, "When I grew up and studied philosophy, I wished I had been able to answer with Socrates saying, 'There is only one thing I know, and this is I know nothing.' I only wished I could get that one back at her." The wedding cake saga also reinforced in her the feeling that she could get away with murder and that she was able to bend others to her will. When, for instance, she decided that mathematics, especially algebra, was beyond her, she convinced her mother to write to her teachers to say it was bad for her health. Alice did as she was bid, informing Arundel School, which Wallace attended near to her Mount Vernon home, that the prospect of algebra brought her daughter out in hives. Again, when the tone-deaf schoolgirl became exasperated learning the piano, she simply hid in the closet from her baffled tutor, Mrs. Jackson. Sometimes her mother could still bring her to heel, on one occasion using a hairbrush on her derriere when in a fit of temper she flung a bottle of black ink on her bed. Her fierce temper got the better of her at school, too. She whacked a fellow student, Jesse Webb, on the head with a pencil case because the boy answered a question in class before she could. Not that she was a bad student. Blessed with a near photographic memory, she was able to skim through most subjects. With somewhat biographical inevitability, her favorite topic was the study of English kings and queens, and did well in exams. What with the simmering domestic tension between mother and daughter, combined with her stepfather's deteriorating health. It was perhaps as well that the much-maligned Uncle Saul agreed to pay for Wallace's enrollment at Old Fields Girls' Boarding School, alma mater to her mother and her Aunt Bessie. The school, founded in 1867 by the McCulloch family, was run on religious lines, with the Bible at the heart of its educational compass. Prayers were said every morning, and girls were encouraged to learn passages from the Bible. At first, the worthy routine did not suit Wallace. Her doting friend, Mary Kirk, informed her mother that Wallace was homesick. "She says she won't come back after Christmas," she wrote in October 1912, shortly after Wallace had joined Mary in their rooms above the new gym. The fact that Wallace's mother and second husband had moved from Baltimore to Atlantic City, hoping that the sea air would be a tonic for the ailing John Rasson, may have contributed to her sense of isolation. It was a blip. Wallace proved herself a star of the basketball team and popular with the other girls, except a few who were, according to Mary, a little bit jealous. Wallace had settled nicely into the Old Fields regime when, on April 4, 1913, headmistress Anna McCulloch, known as Miss Nan, broke the sad news that her stepfather had died suddenly of a heart attack. He was only 44. At his funeral, she was one of the few who remained dry-eyed, Wallace feeling nothing but pity for her mother, who now looked so withered and tiny in her black widow's garb. "I don't give in to my emotions," she observed. "It's a Warfield characteristic, rather like the British stiff upper lip." At a critical time in her adolescence, Wallace was once again faced with straitened circumstances. Her mother moved back to Baltimore and took up cheap lodgings at the Earl's Court apartment building. During holidays, Wallace lived with her mother or her Aunt Bessie, her mother now trying her hand as a real estate agent. While many of her classmates, such as pharmaceutical heiress Renée DuPont, lived in splendid excess, Wallace felt awkward inviting a school friend to her mother's tiny apartment for a cup of tea. Her mother now made every stitch of her clothing, and she could not help but look enviously at the divinely fashionable and original creations her school roommate, Ellen Yule, brought back from family visits to New York. Perhaps Wallace overstated her threadbare wardrobe. Mary Kirk recalled an occasion at a summer camp where all the girls were invited to a dance. Mary wrote to her mother and asked her to send a suitable dress, pointing out that all the girls had the same issue, except Wallace, who has good-looking clothes for every occasion imaginable. Nonetheless, Wallace was at an age where she was continually measuring herself against other girls, assessing the competition in the endless race for boys. As her intense crushes on her teachers and fellow pupils began to fade, she peered more intently into the mysterious world of the opposite sex. Her first regular introduction to these strange creatures was when she took lessons at dancing school. She was utterly enchanted by dance, and learned the various dance steps with eager felicity. Caught up in the thrill of movement and the excitement of performance, she dreamed of one day becoming a ballet dancer. Instead, she took up roller skating. Her friend Mary Kirk was equally starstruck, seeing herself as the second Sarah Bernhardt. Before dance classes, she loved to dress up and then preen and parade before the shy, nervy creatures at the other side of the room. She always chided her Aunt Bessie for telling a story about the time she cast aside a rainbow range of sashes to decorate her dress, picking red because it stood out and would therefore act as a boy magnet. She wanted to ensure that the tremulous excitement she felt as the boys advanced toward the girls to ask them to dance would translate into being one of the first to be chosen. For 16-year-old Wallace, the opportunities to meet and speak to boys were few and far between. At Oldfields, where the day began with the Lord's Prayer and a Bible story, it was against the rules to write to or receive letters from a boy. On one occasion, headmistress Miss Nan tearfully announced after morning prayers that some girls had been writing to boys. For the rest of the day, a line of girls sheepishly waited outside the head's study. Mary Kirk informed her mother that it was a gloomy and awful day. Imagine, then, the excitement when Mary and Wallace walked to church one Sunday and were confronted by a whole lot of boys in the congregation. "Real boys with creases in their pants and collars and ties," wrote Mary. "We were thrilled. Wallace and me in the choir got the best view of them, and everyone else was so envious." When Wallace, the school's standout basketball player, and a friend were given permission to travel to Annapolis to watch an Army and Navy game, it was the talk of Oldfields. The girls were treated as minor celebrities upon their return. As one fellow pupil recalled, "You must realize that the star basketball player would be a heroine in any school. Yet Wallace was completely unspoiled, a good person to be in school with." Daring, too. It is woven into the fabric of Oldfield's history that Wallace would make assignations with young men who would slowly drive their cars down the single-track Glencoe Road that runs alongside the school. At a prearranged signal, she would shimmy down the drainpipe from her third-floor dormitory, known as Heaven, and run across the lawn to meet her waiting beau. Given her keen sense of self-preservation and lifelong physical timidity, it is more likely that she climbed down the nearby iron fire escape. A regular caller was Carter G. Osborne, Jr., a young man who admitted that he was self-hypnotized by Wallace's charms. Osborne, who first met Wallace at a dance at L'Hirondelle, a private social club in Ruxton, recalled, "I don't know yet how she managed to elude the observing eyes of the school matrons, but she was never caught. We would neck, although you never called it that in those days, and then we would go for a drive." Racy behavior indeed. She wasn't always so bold. Once she and several other girls did a bunk from school to go buggy riding. A guard on a nearby estate spotted them and yelled for them to scram. Wallace was so startled at the abrupt discovery and the potential for public shame that she waded into Gunpowder River and threatened to drown herself. Given her physical timidity, it is surprising that she was so daring in her pursuit of a beau. In those days, girls did not have boyfriends, only beaus, and girls went on engagements as opposed to dates. When a young lady was in the company of a suitor, she was always chaperoned, either by her mother, her sister, or a trustworthy friend. The gift of Parma violets or gardenias or candy from an admirer was deemed appropriate. If the young man offered an expensive orchid, it was considered tantamount to a proposal of marriage. When Mary Kirk's beau Andrew sent her a pin adorned with garnets and opals, Miss Nan, with the agreement of her parents, made her send it back. It was deemed way too extravagant. Holding hands was about the limit of physical contact, and any girl who allowed a beau to give her a goodnight kiss was considered fast indeed. This was a time when men were bold, girls were coy, and parents perpetually nervous. A time, too, of sexual innocence, not to say ignorance. In temperament, if not demeanor, Wallace was closer to a Victorian holdout than a loose-limbed flapper. She was a talker and a tease, happy to playfully kiss her beaus and gossip about the mysteries of sex, but terrified of anything resembling the act itself. She saw herself as an exotic vamp, imitating the silent screen queens of the day. Before she made an entrance, Wallace ensured that her hair, carefully parted down the middle, was brushed 100 times each side to keep it fashionably flat. Presentation was all. For Wallace, Mary, and her other friends, the school holidays, particularly Christmas and Easter, were the real occasions for meeting boys. According to one admirer, she attracted men like molasses attracts flies. At dances and other social events during school holidays, Wallace quickly gained a reputation as the belle of the ball. With her striking blue eyes, slim figure, and ready, exuberant laughter, she seemed to stand out from the crowd. No matter that her clothes were homemade, potential beaux would stand three deep for the honor of the next waltz, bunny hug, turkey trot, or foxtrot. She excelled at the castle walk, a dance popularized by ballroom dancers Vernon and Irene Castle, then at the peak of their fame and influence. "Wallace put on quite a show," recalled an admiring school friend, Virginia Saunders Hughes. Invariably, the young man who was first in line to lead Wallace onto the dance floor was the diminutive, if loquacious, Carter Osborne. As the son of the vice president of the Farmers and Merchants Bank, Osborne's great advantage over other suitors was that he was able to borrow his father's luxury, sleek, black Packard automobile. Wallace turned up her nose at boys who arrived at her mother's apartment in borrowed Fords and other more proletarian vehicles. "Not quite as exciting," she commented dryly. Osborne was not the only one in the race for Wallace's hand. His nearest rival was the tall, dark, and silent, but, alas, Ford-driving, Arthur Stump, a member of a prominent, if controversial, Maryland legal family. The other runners and riders included Fletcher Green, Harvey Rowland, and Tom Shryock, later a colonel in the National Guard. Osborne tried to firmly establish his claim when he presented her with a horse. Wallace thought this ostentatious gift was not proper and farmed it out to her Aunt Bessie. When she was not showing off her skills on the dance floor, Wallace was busy being Wallace, laughing, gay, and arch. At all these parties, Wallace was the center of everything, and I was her adoring swain, recalled the love-struck Osborne. She could tell a story with verve and charm, a gift she had inherited from her mother. Not everyone was impressed. Wallace, as she would do throughout her life, had the knack of polarizing opinion. While she and her loyal friend Mary Kirk were thick as thieves, constantly on the telephone, the Kirk family viewed her as a malign influence and were somewhat shocked when she announced during dinner that the man she would one day marry would have to have lots of money. It was, as Mary's elder sister Bucky later recalled, the kind of thing a nice girl never said out loud. Nor did nice girls deliberately set out to snare beaux who were wooing their school friends. Precocious in the ways of the world, Wallace instinctively practiced the basic techniques of seduction, methods that served her well for the rest of her life. First, she found out about a boy's interests, and then was raptly attentive as he talked about his plans and passions, her mesmerizing blue eyes never wavering as she gazed adoringly at her prey. In short order, his interests became her interests, Wallace collecting admirers as acquisitively as, in later life, she would collect jewelry. If they were another girl's beau, so much the better, that evening's conquest confirming her desirability. Her cousin, the writer Upton Sinclair, knew her well enough to give voice to her seduction techniques in a one-act play titled Wally for Queen, which he penned at the time of the abdication. "Don't forget," Wallace tells the king, "I'm a Baltimore girl, and we are terrors. We practice impertinence. It's supposed to be cute. We vamp our dancing partners at the age of 4. Men have no chance at all in our town." Dr. Parnell Hagerman, the former head of school at Oldfields, who has spoken to the families of Wallace's contemporaries, concludes that Wallace alienated many other girls in her relentless attempts to date boys, available or not, and whether or not she wanted them. Hagerman observes, "She became very adept at breaking up relationships, at getting what she wanted. The way she did it seems very normal to our eyes, but at her age and time it was very sophisticated." With the tunnel vision of the lovesick, Wallace's beau, Carter Osborne, sensed the hostility toward his girl but blamed her rivals. She was a real man's girl, and other girls envied her with all their catty little hearts. Wallace's pithy phrase, "all is love," which she wrote in the girl's yearbook when she finished school in the spring of 1914, is greeted with a cynical grimace by Dr. Hagerman. "Yeah, right," growls the Bostonian. Not that Wallace would have cared one jot. From the moment she kissed and hugged her flower-bedecked classmates at the farewell May Day parade, Wallace had only one thing on her mind.